Many of the subjects that I address at Holden are great problems with me, and so I use that opportunity to investigate it to help myself and hopefully helping somebody else. So I will be talking to you initially on some of my own experiences in this, and then I'll tell you some of the things that we have learned about pain, and then we'll open it up for discussion. And I'm using a broad definition of pain today. It's the first one in a long column of definitions of pain. And it is a mental or physical lack of well-being, or a mental or physical uneasiness. It may vary from a mild pain to excruciating, debilitating pain. And to give you some idea of dimension, it is noteworthy that one often looks at cost. There are presently in the United States 36 million arthritics who have pain, and I'm one of those. 7 million have back pain. I happen to be one of those. There are 20 million who have migraine headaches. I only have mild headaches. There are probably about 900,000, almost a million, who have cancer pain. Probably worldwide about 16 million. And it has been recently estimated by Bonica, John Bonica, who I'll be telling you about later, that perhaps at any one time, one-third of the population is suffering pain, and half of those are suffering an incapacitating pain for days to weeks to months to years. And he estimates that this is probably costing us $70 billion a year. So the effect here on our nation exceeds that of cancer and heart disease, which are regarded as our largest ones. I will not discuss very much loneliness today. That's also a pain, and probably one of our worst diseases, as I told you last night. So that's the start of it. Now, what is my interest and experience in this? And it is varied, and then I'll get into that, and then we'll sort of give some of the recent observations that might explain some of the observations that I made. And I am, as I've gotten older and as people get older, one is seldom without pain. And one of the things that's bothered me, because I was raised on a farm, is do animals experience the same kind of pain as we do? Because when I was growing up, you did a lot of operations without benefit of anesthesia. And this really bothered me. You'd cut off their tails or castrate them without the benefit of anesthesia. But pain is, what we must recognize, is also a great benefit to us. And I learned that early. I went to the dentist a lot. And then Novocaine came in to use, and he injected it, and my whole side of my face was numb. And I was chewing on my lip, not knowing that it didn't hurt until after the anesthesia wore off. And it was awful. It was worse than the toothache. And that brings to mind, and I'll interject it here early, that there is a genetic disease in which people are born without the ability to detect pain. And they're usually in terrible shape because they do all kinds of things and are not obvious that they are causing themselves great harm, and that they're a disaster area. It's really terrible. So there is benefit in pain. Early on, I was burned very severely on one occasion, not as seriously. And my brother challenged me when I was very small, when my father was burning ferns and brush, that after the fire had died down, that I'd run through it, which I did, and caught on fire. I didn't listen to him so much after that. But it does point out that you learn from these kind of experiences. And when I was about 4 years old, I was laying by the stove. My aunt was visiting us, and I think she liked me. In fact, I think she loved me. But she sort of tripped as she took a great big pan of boiling hot water off the stove and dumped it on my back. And that pain was very excruciating, and it's taught me to always respect fire and heat. And I still carry sort of a map of Africa on my back. But I remember these terrible times because my mother, who was very diligent to obey the doctor's orders, would re-bandage it, I think, every day. And I'd go and hide. He'd have to find me. Although I was tried to be a dutiful son, but this was very excruciating. But there is one thing about it: I cannot feel that pain now. I mean, I knew it was terrible, and I'd go and hide. But it is fortunate, isn't it, that the pain is mercifully difficult to recall in most cases. If it weren't, there'd only be one child born per family. And in grade school and high school, I remember playing in a lot of athletic events. And in the excitement of the game, you could be injured, but you'd keep going. But when the game was over, if you lost, the pain usually started, when you were really severely losing. But if you won, it would take a while. It would take a while, but then you couldn't run 5 feet, where before you were running hard and tackling and doing all these wild things. And I noticed that when I was too small to play on any sport in high school, so they made me manager. And I was still under 100 pounds. But I remember this because I had to treat the wounded. Rap and listen to them complain. And I recognized this, they'd be going hard during the game. And then I had them both on the couch and the bench trying to fix them up afterwards. Well, we see this today, don't we, in all athletic events. These people play with shoulders out of joint and a lot of other things. The game is in the heat of battle. We see this in bringing up battle. I mentioned last night to some of you who were here that I observed this a lot in the heat of battle, that the experience of pain was a function a lot of the attitude and the circumstance, where I remember on one occasion a recruit was really scared. Dreaded this on a landing, and in recalling this event, probably the worst pain he'd ever suffered was he thought he was hit. Really, his canteen was hit, and of course the water flowed down his leg. You see, he thought it was all blood, and the pain was absolutely terrible. Another occasion, the worst pain he had was he had facial pain from a superficial wound. But when I think he lost his leg, and hardly felt that at all. And I noticed that a lot of times the amount of pain one experienced didn't seem to have anything to do with the nature of the lesion. So this was sort of confusing. And I mentioned last night about Anzio. They call the Anzio phenomena. When our people were hit there, the soldiers were hit. It didn't take much morphine to relieve the pain, compared with the civilians who had to stay there, because if you were severely hit, it's back to America. So you had hope for return. And I think sick calls probably in the army and other places are a function whether the news was bad or good. I noticed that in the attendance at one in a permanent ground force officer's camp in a Polish quarter where I was. When the news was bad, I remember the biggest attendance was when the rumor went out that Hitler was going to kill all the prisoners of war. There was big attendance at church that day when the rumor was spread. I'm sure there was pain associated with this. And I also learned that fairly early that when I go to a dentist, and it was especially in the early days, and I don't like to take any painkillers unless I really have to, I'd pinch myself, and then the pain wasn't as bad. And in the early days in veterinary medicine, some of you are familiar with this, they often put a twitch on either the nose, the lip here, or the ear. When you're going to do a painful procedure, so you don't get kicked for go airborne for 15 or 20 feet. You have somebody put the twitch on as a counter pain. Well, I'll tell you the reasons for that, why this worked. And one of the things, in going to Alaska, this sort of probably as an aside, but I don't know if you've thought about it, but moose, I wondered for a long time whether, you know, they seem to feel no pain. They're standing in cold water. Sometimes it's colder. It's always cold, but sometimes it's colder. Knee deep in it and sticking their head under water. Or they're taking off across the highway. If a car gets in the way, they run over it or hit it. And it seemed to not bother them at all. And it brings out, this is a theory of mine. You see, they eat willows. And willow bark is where you get salicylic acid. It's aspirins. So they're always on an aspirin high. That's just an aside for you. When the conversation starts getting sort of somber or something, you can throw that in. I also learned fairly early in the business. In the old days, when I was growing up, one of the ways you handled old people was to put some heroin by their bedside when they were in great pain, and they'd take it as they needed it. And a lot of the old timers said, "Boy, that's a great, great drug." Now, Bev, you can help me on this. I think this went out about 1956. I think they said no more heroin, right? Somewhere around there. They still allowed in England. And there's a big to-do about this at the present time in the United States. I don't know if you're familiar with it. There's a lot of people that would like to reinstitute the use of morphine in this country. I mean, heroin in this country. And there's a lady named Judith Quattlebaum who's leading the charge on this. And they're hoping to run it through both houses of Congress this year. And they feel that in many cases, this could help some people at least. Those who are opposed to it say, well, then you'll just increase the number of people that black market this stuff out of the hospitals. And they also say that, well, it's true, it's more soluble, and maybe you don't have some of the effects of morphine, because you do have some bad dreams of this and other problems. But there is some work to indicate that heroin is converted to morphine in the body. But this is still up for grabs. Because there's one thing that you must recognize in all of this. And it's something that I have a hard time with my students, both when I was teaching in medical school and veterinary school, is that everybody deals on the average. You know? They should respond this way. And that's a typical case, or the average case. I want to point out to you, as I point out to them, there's only one average. One person's average. Everybody is unique, a unique creation of a great creator. We respond usually somewhat differently to these things, where one thing will work for some one person, it won't work for another. So we must be aware of this. Now there are new synthetics being developed, which I might mention later, one person I met, who is one of the truly great people of the world, is Dame Cicely Saunders. I became interested in her because I was interested in the hospice movement, the treatment of terminally ill, and also because she used animals in St. Christopher's. She has I could give you an hour on Dame Cicely, but I won't. But she became very interested in pain and the control of pain in the terminally ill. And that's why she started up St. Christopher's in South London. And it's a unique hospice. And it's sort of the pattern for a lot of hospices in the world. And she sort of looked as the grand dame of hospices. And she's a remarkable, remarkable woman. She was knighted for her work on pain. I think she developed the Brompton cocktail, which has heroin in it. It also has some phenothiazine derivatives. I think a judicious sprinkling of gin and a few other things. But she feels that it's so critical to control the pain of the terminally ill. And when you go to St. Christopher's, I imagine the majority of the patients there are without pain within 24 to 48 hours. And she thinks this is so important so that they can be relieved of this excruciating pain for some of those that have it. And they have resident animals there. That's one of the reasons I was interested in to go there. And also they have visiting privileges for the pets. The pets can come in and see the people. And there are many stories about this. She told me one day that she contracted, had an elephant come up and see the patients. And her husband, she just recently married. And I've been after her to get a picture of her with an animal. So she sent me a picture of her husband with his But she said he was a cat lover and did him a lot of good. But she was knighted. She was also awarded the Templeton Award about 2 years ago, the year after Mother Teresa got it. And Templeton, as a philanthropist, said that advances in religion are more important than advances in science. So he established the Templeton Award, which is bigger than the Nobel Prize, cash-wise. And she plowed essentially all of it back into St. Christopher's for her work on this. And if you can get some of her readings, they're really worthwhile. She's a remarkable person. And I'm grateful for having made her acquaintance. She refers to me as the animal man. As a follow-up on this, what we're trying to do is to get more animals with the terminally ill and allow people with important animals to bring them with them. We're starting in on hospices and then we'll move to hospitals. I consult with the Prince and Princess of Wales Hospice in Glasgow, Scotland, where they're planning a large hospice And Mary Stewart and I, Mary Stewart is a veterinarian at Glasgow, and we've been up there and consulted, hoping that they will have at least part of the facility where a person can bring their animal with them and keep them there. And there's no reason for this. Schweitzer, of course, did this, didn't he? Bring the whole family and the animals to his hospital in Lambourine for convenience, but also to maintain the intact family community. Now, I have also noted in my experience that, and I'll give you a concrete example of that fairly recently. One of the brightest people on our staff, and we have quite a few of those, this fellow he came from Canada via Australia, probably one of the leading animal clinicians in the world. And he told me one day about his father, who was a professional man, who had now moved to Oregon. And by his description, it was obvious that he had terminal cancer. Lung, he had smoked a good deal. And he was always telling about all his problems and all his pains. And that's the only subject he ever talked about. I said, where is he living? There's some room around him. And he says, well, yes. Has he ever had any kind of animals? Oh, yeah, loved retrievers. I says, why don't you get him a golden retriever, one that you could live with, because you may have to live with him, and take it down to him, which he did. And then he wasn't long after he dropped by, and he says, you know, I had a remarkable effect on my father. Now he calls me up. He doesn't talk anything about his own problems. He's talking about that dog all the time and all the crazy things it does. Well, I've seen that happen so many times now. So it's a diversion thing, and it gets a lot of laughs. Well, for those of you who had, I don't know if you ever met Norman Cousins when you were down there, Gretchen, but Norman Cousins is he's one of the consultant staff to the Delta Society, but he was Saturday Review editor for many, many years. And then he got a very terrible disease, a collagen disease. It was excruciating pain, and it was probably going to end him. So his doctors didn't know what to do with him, and nobody else did either. And he couldn't sleep very much, and he was going down the tubes. And one of the things he did was he checked out of the hospital and got a hotel room because the food was better. And didn't wake him up so early in the morning. And they didn't make fun of him when he had crazy movies, like some of the Marx Brothers movies and You're on Candid Camera and stuff. And he'd see these movies and get a lot of belly laughs out of them. And then he'd be able to sleep for a while. And that's how he essentially came back. He also administered a lot of vitamin C or zinc or something. I think this laughter probably did it for him. He wrote a book about it, The Anatomy of Pain. It was very interesting. And after that, UCLA Medical School hired him on their faculty. And then he had a heart attack. And he's recently described that. I forgot the name of the book, but it's a great book. He knows how to put complex things into simple language. It's a great, great facility for this. So that's why I mentioned this laughter thing. As I noted last night, that's one thing that the animals properly selected will do for you. Grade school and high school, I remember playing in a lot of athletic events. And the excitement of the game. You could be injured, but you'd keep going. But when the game was over, if you lost, the pain usually started, you know, when you were really severely losing. But if you won, it would take a while. Huh? It would take a while. But then you couldn't run 5 feet, where before you were running hard and tackling and doing all these wild things. And I noticed that when I was too small to play on any sport in high school, so they made me manager. And I was still under 100 pounds, but I remember this because I had to treat the wounded, rap and listen to them complain. And I recognized this, you know. They'd be going hard during the game. And then I had them both on the couch and the bench trying to fix them up afterwards. Well, we see this today, don't we, in all athletic events. These people play with shoulders out of joint and a lot of other things. The game is in the heat of battle. We see this in bringing up battle. I mentioned last night to some of you who were here that I observed this a lot in the heat of battle. That the experience of pain was a function a lot of the attitude and the circumstance. I remember on one occasion a recruit was really scared, dreaded this on a landing, in recalling this event, probably the worst pain he'd ever suffered was he thought he was hit. Really, his canteen was hit. And of course, the water flowed down his leg. He thought it was all blood. And the pain was absolutely terrible. Another occasion, the worst pain he had was he had facial pain from a superficial wound. But when I think he lost his leg, and I hardly felt that at all. And I noticed that a lot of times the amount of pain one experienced didn't seem to have anything to do with the nature of the lesion. So this was sort of confusing. And I mentioned last night about Anzio. They call the Anzio phenomena. When our people were hit there, the soldiers were hit, it didn't take much morphine to relieve the pain compared with the civilians who had to stay there. Because if you were severely hit, it's back to America. So you had hope for return. And I think sick calls probably in the army and other places are a function whether the news was bad or good. I noticed that in the attendance at one in a permanent ground force officer's camp in a Polish quarter where I was. When the news was bad, I remember the biggest attendance was when the rumor went out that Hitler was going to kill all the prisoners of war. There was big attendance at church that day when the rumor was spread. I'm sure there was pain associated with this. And I also learned it fairly early that when I go to a dentist, and it was especially in the early days, and I don't like to take any painkillers unless I really have to. I'd pinch myself, and then the pain wasn't as bad. And in the early days in veterinary medicine, some of you who are familiar with this, they often put a twitch on either the nose, the lip here, or the ear, when you're going to do a painful procedure, so you don't get kicked for go airborne for 15 or 20 feet. You have somebody put the twitch on as a counter pain. Well, I'll tell you the reasons for that, why this worked. And one of the things in going to Alaska, this sort of probably as an aside, but I don't know if you've thought about it, but moose, I wonder for a long time whether, you know, they seem to feel no pain. They're standing in cold water. Sometimes it's colder. It's always cold, but sometimes it's colder. Knee deep in it and sticking their head under water. Or they're taking off across the highway. If a car gets in the way, they run over it or hit it. And it seemed to not bother them at all. And it brings out, this is a theory of mine. You see, they eat willows. And willow bark is where you get salicylic acid. It's aspirins. So they're always on an aspirin high. That's just an aside for him. When the conversation starts getting sort of somber or something, you can throw that in. I also learned fairly early in the business. In the old days, when I was growing up, one of the ways you handled old people was to put some heroin by their bedside when they were in great pain, and they'd take it as they needed it. And a lot of the old timers said, boy, that's a great, great drug. Now, Bev, you can help me on this. I think this went out, about 1956, I think. They said no more heroin, right? Somewhere around there. They still allowed in England. And there's a big to-do about this at the present time in the United States. I don't know if you're familiar with it. There's a lot of people that would like to reinstitute the use of morphine in this heroin in this country. And there's a lady named Judith Quattlebaum who's leading the charge on this. And they're hoping to run it through both houses of Congress this year. And they feel that in many cases this could help some people at least. Those who are opposed to it say, well, then you'll just increase the number of people that black market this stuff out of the hospitals. And they also say that, well, it's true, it's more soluble, and maybe you don't have some of the effects of morphine, because you do have some bad dreams of this and other problems. But there is some work to indicate that heroin is converted to morphine in the body. But this is still up for grabs, because there's one thing that you must recognize in all of this. And it's something that I have a hard time with my students, both when I was teaching in medical school and veterinary school, is that everybody deals on the average. They should respond this way. And that's a typical case, or the average case. I want to point out to you, as I point out to them, there's only one average. One person's average. Everybody is unique, a unique creation of a great creator. We respond usually somewhat differently to these things, where one thing will work for some one person, it won't work for another. So we must be aware of this. And now there are new synthetics being developed, which I might mention later. But one person I met, who is one of the truly great people of the world, is Dame Cicely Saunders. I became interested in her because I was interested in the hospice movement, the treatment of terminally ill, and also because she used animals in St. Christopher's. She has I could give you an hour on Dame Cicely, but I won't. But she became very interested in pain and the control of pain in the terminally ill. And that's why she started up St. Christopher's in South London. And it's a unique hospice. And it's sort of the pattern for a lot of hospices in the world. And she sort of looked as the grand dame of hospices. And she's a remarkable, remarkable woman. She was knighted for her work on pain. I think she developed the Brompton cocktail, which has heroin in it. It also has some phenothiazine derivatives. I think a judicious sprinkling of gin and a few other things. But she feels that it's so critical to control the pain of the terminally ill. And when you go to St. Christopher's, I imagine the majority of the patients there are without pain within 24 to 48 hours. She thinks this is so important so that they can be relieved of this excruciating pain for some of those that have it. And they have resident animals there. That's one of the reasons I was interested in to go there. And also they have visiting privileges for the pets. The pets can come in and see the people. And there are many stories about this. She told me one day that she contracted, had an elephant come up and see the patients. And her husband, she just recently married, and I've been after her to get a picture of her with an animal. So she sent me a picture of her husband with his. Well, she said he was a cat lover, and did him a lot of good. But she was knighted. She was also awarded the Templeton Award. That's about 2 years ago, the year after Mother Teresa got it. And Templeton, as a philanthropist, said that advances in religion are more important than advances in science. So he established the Templeton Award, which is bigger than the Nobel Prize, cash-wise. And she plowed essentially all of it back into St. Christopher's for her work on this. And if you can get some of her readings, they're really worthwhile. She's a remarkable person. And I'm grateful for having made her acquaintance. She refers to me as the animal man. As a follow-up on this, what we're trying to do is to get more animals with the terminally ill and allow people with important animals to bring them with them. We're starting in on hospices, and then we'll move to hospitals. I consult with the Prince and Princess of Wales Hospice in Glasgow, Scotland, where they're planning a large hospice. And Mary Stewart is a veterinarian at Glasgow. And we've been up there and consulted, hoping that they will have at least part of the facility where a person can bring their animal with them and keep them there. And there's no reason for this. Schweitzer, of course, did this, didn't he? Bring the whole family and the animals to his hospital in Lambourine for convenience, but also to maintain intact the family community. Now, I have also noted in my experience that, and I'll give you a concrete example of that fairly recently. One of the brightest people on our staff, and we have quite a few of those, this fellow he came from Canada via Australia, probably one of the leading animal clinicians in the world. And he told me one day about his father, who was a professional man, who'd now moved to Oregon. And by his description, it was obvious that he had terminal cancer. Lung, he had smoked a good deal. And he was always telling about all his problems and all his pains. And that's the only subject he ever talked about. I said, where is he living? There's some room around him. And he says, well, yes. Has he ever had any kind of animals? Oh, yeah, loved retrievers. I says, why don't you get him a golden retriever, one that you could live with, because you may have to live with him, and take it down to him, which he did. And then he wasn't long after he dropped by, and he says, you know, I had a remarkable effect on my father. Now he calls me up. He doesn't talk anything about his own problems. He's talking about that dog all the time and all the crazy things it does. Well, I've seen that happen so many times now. So it's a diversion thing, and it gets a lot of laughs. Well, for those of you who had, I don't know if you ever met Norman Cousins when you were down there, Gretchen, but Norman Cousins is he's one of the consultant staff to the Delta Society, but he was Saturday Review editor for many, many years. And then he got a very terrible disease, a collagen disease. It was excruciating pain, and it was probably going to end him. So his doctors didn't know what to do with him, and nobody else did either. And he couldn't sleep very much, and he was going down the tubes. And one of the things he did was he checked out of the hospital and got a hotel room because the food was better, and didn't wake him up so early in the morning. And they didn't make fun of him when he had crazy movies, like some of the Marx Brothers movies, and you're on candid camera and stuff. And he'd see these movies, and get a lot of belly laughs out of him. And then he'd be able to sleep for a while. And that's how he essentially came back. Well, he also administered a lot of vitamin C or zinc or something. I think this laughter probably did it for him. He wrote a book about it, The Anatomy of Pain. It's very interesting. And after that, UCLA Medical School hired him on their faculty. And then he had a heart attack. And he's recently described that. I forgot the name of the book, but it's a great book. He knows how to put complex things into simple language. There's a great, great facility for this. So that's why I mentioned this laughter thing. As I noted last night, that's one thing that the animals properly selected will do for you. Now, so much for some of my experience. I want to talk now about some of the things we've learned about this. And one of the people I want to tell you about right initially, because I got sort of interested in this when I was at the University of Washington doing my graduate work in the School of Medicine there in the late 50s. And a lot of people told me about John Bonica, great big guy. He worked his way through New York University Medical School as Johnny Bull Walker, a professional wrestler. he went into anesthesiology. Well, right after he, I think, finished his degree, he ended up in Fort Lewis during the war, and I suppose the average run of patients there from the mainly South Pacific were about 7,000, so he had a lot of people to deal with. And he was disturbed that there weren't really any specialists on handling pain. Nobody really knew very much about pain. In fact, he just recently, in 1983, he reviewed about 17 of the leading medical texts and checked them out to how many pages of the 220,000 or something were dealt with pain. I think there were 54 pages on pain. And half of the books didn't even mention it. So we're just more recently coming out of the dark ages as far as pain goes. And he started looking at this, and I suppose a few others at that time, at World War II and what to deal with this. And he talked to a lot of disciplines about this. You know, what do you do about pain? And a lot of people started to investigate it. He came to the University of Washington. I think he was in Tacoma in practice there, and they hired him at the University of Washington, I think, fortunately for them. And he set up a pain clinic, probably one of the first in the world. And it was very successful. It's still going on. He himself knows something about pain because he can't stand more than just a few minutes before he's in excruciating pain. I think he's had about 22 operations on his hips and legs. He has one leg that's about an inch and a half shorter than the other one. And so he is in fact, he says if he wasn't busy, he'd be an invalid. He still scuba dives. He's given up water skiing, but he still goes. He's born in Sicily. It's very lovely swimming off Sicily. I did that unintentionally the first time. I got washed off overboard. But when I did it for pleasure, it was a lot of fun. He scuba dives down there. But he's very busy with this. In fact, to have somebody relieve your pain, I guess you get a good audience of admirers. And every year, even now, though he's retired or semi-retired, he's still very busy. Every year they have a John Bonica night. People come from all over to have dinner with him. So he's a very interesting person and has done a lot for a lot of people. But investigations of this, what they found out, I think at Montefiore Hospital and other places, was that in investigating people who were in pain in the hospital, they found out that 75% of the people there, their pain was not relieved by the opiates that were being given. And in checking on this, they found out that they weren't giving a big enough dose. That the majority were probably getting half the dose they should have been, or a quarter of the dose that would probably do the job. Because everybody's so hung up on becoming addicted. I mean, some people have an addiction. Somebody's going to die in 2 weeks, you know. They're afraid they're going to addict them. So like last night, Elmer was telling about this, you know, why his wife ordered a hamburger. She couldn't eat, but she ordered a hamburger anyway. After all, I'm going to die anyway. What's the hazard? So I think we're having a relook at that. And another thing, in fact, most of what we know about pain and its handling and the nature of it, we've still got a long ways to go, has been learned in the last 20 years. And in fact, it's only 9 years ago. And that's why we've wondered about a lot of things, because sometimes people in what you'd say should be really suffering from terrible pain aren't showing any pain at all. And 9 years ago, the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, building on work done in this country and other countries, isolated a compound which they named endorphins, which is produced within us. Huh? And it's better than morphine. It's better than morphine. And it's a class of compounds that are very, very interesting. And they'll probably be manufacturing those with bacteria and other things with genetic engineering and monoclonal antibody techniques. But I should tell you something before that, that a couple of fellows named Wall and Melzack, you know, they were looking at all the data and studying this, and they proposed a theory that's called the gate control theory of pain, where that our system can only handle a certain input, a level of input of sensory information, and then you overwhelm the system. And they say it's like a gate, you see, and when it overwhelms, the gate closes and doesn't take anymore.